Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Show and Sleeve Show.
That's me. That's me, too.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my shoes. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my shoes.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
And we are off. I just looked up at the ceiling here for a moment, which small action reminded me. Where I saw nothing, I looked at the ceiling, and it was pure and utter ceiling. And sometimes you look up at the blue sky, and it's pure and utter blue sky. I look at the ceiling, it's pure and utter ceiling, but which means there's nothing non-ceiling going on up there. It's everywhere is ceiling. But it reminds me of the ceiling in my bedroom, above my bed. A wooden ceiling. Where I wake, when I wake, I sleep on my back. I'm a back sleeper. When I was a boy, I slept on my stomach, and then I turned onto my side in my teenage years, and then onto my back. And I'm slowly turning over. I'm aiming toward the other side, I believe, now, and then finally come to rest on the stomach again. But during the back years, most recent back years, I awoke one morning, eyes popped open, staring at the ceiling, no idea who I am. It's that moment when you have no idea. It's hard to catch it. It's an important moment of re-becoming who you are. I try to catch it sometimes, other times it can be a cold and disjointed feeling, so it's not something I'm often pursuing, but occasionally I like to remember that I don't know who I am. And I have to remember who I am. And so, when my eyes open, I catch that moment of ignorance. It's a newborn moment, neonatal moment of awareness and discontinuity, because you're not connected to anything. You don't know your name, who you are. So, I don't know, it's a flash, and then it all comes back, and there you're sitting in the seat of your own life history. But the eyes pop open. I don't know who I am, and then when I know who I am, I'm looking at the ceiling, and I acknowledge it. I am showing sleeves in my bed, looking at the ceiling, and it's not as formal, it's automatic, it's an automatic presentation of the universe and self in it. And I see upon my ceiling something I've seen before many, many times, but failed to acknowledge in the way that I've just acknowledged myself. Something that should not be on the ceiling. Something that should never be on the ceiling unless someone has attached these small things. I'm playing it out. Playing it out. But I'll stop playing it out. But here's what it is. There are... My ceiling is made of wood. These wooden beams. These wooden beams that are actually not as smooth as you might imagine. So I've gotten splinters as I've done things up there. If you run your hand along it, you get a little splinter. It's mostly smooth, but it's old, so the wood is threading apart. So, upon this old ceiling above my bed, I see this display of bird feathers stuck to the ceiling, baby feathers, like down. The sort of things that if you go up there, which I did, I went up and I grabbed one. I thought, why? How can this be here? And then I thought maybe someone has glued these feathers to the ceiling. And I very delicately pulled one down. I got a stepladder, up the stepladder, pull one of these small feathers down. And I can feel its attraction to the ceiling, something it would prefer, maybe perhaps it's static electricity. It's a magnetic attraction to the ceiling. So I take this feather down. I leave the others there to let the mystery live. And I simply look at the feather as I'm having tea. And I take it out periodically, and I wonder what bird made this feather. And then suddenly it occurs to me, oh, it must be from my pillow. My pillow. My pillow is leaking feathers. Somehow they're squirting out the side as I sleep and rising to the ceiling. So I take the feather out and I bring it into the bedroom and I set it on the pillow to see if it will somehow float upward. And then I lay down on the bed and I push the feather off and it falls to the floor. And it's sensitive to the tiniest breeze or scuffle of shoes, so even reaching for one of these feathers pushes the feather away. So if you reach too fast for the feather, it escapes, it runs off. So then, after I successfully, slowly grab the feather and get it back in my pocket, as it's become sort of an object that I need to temporarily keep. Sometimes we have these things that you want to keep them for a while. I'll hold on to this. This is important. This is like my decoder ring. I put it in my pocket. And then I begin to examine my pillow for signs of some hole, some way that this feather has shot out. And that's when I recognize that my pillow is not a feather pillow. It's just an old, terrible pillow, the likes of which has driven the country nearly to its knees. And then I think, well, maybe it's I have some feathery object in this room. I have a comforter or something, and I can find no feathery friend in the room. And then I lay back down on the bed, stare again upwards at the ceiling above my bed, at this scattering, this constellation of down, of feathers. Again, we are under the influence of the soundscape.
He said, quote, "Whoever believes himself able, directly or indirectly, to withstand this national command will fall. Traitors can expect nothing but death," unquote. And it is significant that the published and official text is edited. It does not conform exactly to the phonograph record of the speech.
Thank you. Our Navy skipper dipped the plane down to 500 feet, and there below, on glass-like water, but water strewn with wreckage and oil, was the Andrea Doria listing at a 45-degree angle and taking water by the minute. She was listing to starboard, the ugly gash in her side covered by the Atlantic. A couple of miles away was the Stockholm, her bow stove in, limping to port, her passengers watching from the forecastle. We made another pass over the Andrea Doria. Her three swimming pools were empty of water, empty the hard way, spilled into the ocean.
So we are once again under the influence of a landscape of sound outside of our knowledge or control. It's a very artful news story, that, about the sinking of the Andrea Doria. Very literary and novel-like and somewhat terrifying. So, if I might continue the story of the feather. Down in Lemon, we have, near this auxiliary building, what most people call the pet store. And it is not exactly a pet store, though they do sell some animals, gerbils and fish and other things, but they also deal in trading cards. It's more of just a peculiar eccentricity shop. As Halloween and other holidays come around, they transform slightly. They cater to seasonal needs. Sell costumes and Christmas ornaments at different times of the year. In the summer, they sell swimsuits and fins and snorkels. Always with these mice and gerbils and tarantulas and snakes and small fish bowls in the background. But the owner, and birds, they sell a number of birds. What I call Woolworth birds. Most of you are probably too young to remember Woolworths, but department store, it had a pet section. And I was, as a boy, I loved the pet section, especially the birds. This strange variety of exotic but dull birds, parakeets, other things like that. They all seemed drained of their former glorious colors, faded blues and faded yellows. And they were either very angry birds or they were completely stoic and stood on their little wooden pegs. So they sell down at the, what we call the pet store, it has another name, I don't remember it. J. Grigson's and Sons or something like that. But I decided I would take my feather in to speak to Gregson and see if he could tell me what bird it came from, this small bit of down. And I go out walking along the road. It's going to takes me 20 or 30 minutes to get into town. And something I've never really it's the return of our train. I suppose we've missed it. I know a fellow who always missed the train. It's a strange permanent state. Every day he'd miss a train. He'd get the next one, but the one he was aiming for he always missed. I stop, I'm just listening. So So I don't know how many of you go out walking along the roads or have recently or have noticed this, but it is often the case, if you're out on the roads, if a car passes, that you can smell the occupants and the interior of the car itself, even if the windows are shut. It brings its own fragrance along, not just the fragrance of petrol and oil and rubber and machinery engaged. It brings the fragrance. It's like opening someone's front door of their house and pushing your face inside and taking a deep breath. You know that experience when you go over someone's home and you smell their peculiar creation of their life and what they do. It's often off-putting. It often is disturbing. And then often it's familiar. You think, oh, I've smelled this before. I've met people that smelled exactly like you. It's a mixture of food and soap and rugs and materials, everything that goes into a life. But you can smell this on the road, a similar, smaller microcosm of the car as it goes past. It's often strong, foul things. Cigarette smoke, cigars, alcohol, illegal substances, animals, dogs, old dog rugs, mold, all in a quick pass. Even car fresheners, sprays to clean things. Someone's going to the dump, you can smell the repulsive, wretched garbage floating along. So I'm walking along with a feather in my pocket, heading to Grigson's. And this old station wagon rumbles past. It's rusty over the wheels, and it's one of those false wooden panels along the side. You don't see these very often. A car that I would, if I saw in the distance, I would know as it was approaching would be redolent with odours and fragrance. And so as such a car, the car actually passed me from behind, so I didn't get a chance to look at it. But if it had been coming the other way, I would have tried to get as close a look at the driver as I could, knowing that I was about to smell their existence and thus get to know them in some way. Like an animal seeing another animal in the forest, getting to know something about it, not for any particular reason. I didn't want to think much about them. I didn't want to think, well, they smell terrible, I don't like them, or they smell wonderful, or... But it's interesting. I find it interesting, compelling. And it's somewhat intimate, and I feel that I know them. And whether that's true or not, I don't know if it's possible to say. I know them in the way that I want to know them. I think of them in the way that I want to think of them. It's not a positive or negative. So I say all that, and then the car is coming the other way, so I don't get to see who it is in the car. But as it passes, and I smell the old coats, the food on the floor, a strange smell of smoke, like house smoke, as though there was a chimney inside the car, which makes me think that they live in a home without heat. They just have fireplaces and wood stoves, and perhaps the flue is blocked and their clothing is suffused with wood smoke. But then there's also alongside this the curious scent of coffee and cherries and very old paper. And immediately I think, well, that's the Three Musketeers. Alexandre Dumas, Three Musketeers. I should go back and explain that somewhat. When I was a boy, I believed I had all manner of powers. Not a superhero concept. Not really. Perhaps it's what the superhero concept might be based on. I think children have these fantasies about themselves. But I believed, for example, that I had power over the wind. I would say, make the wind blow very slow. And if I wanted to speed the wind up, I could say another chant. If I want to slow it down, I say another one. I also believed that I had extraordinary hearing. All my senses were keener than anyone else's. Despite the fact that I wore glasses, I thought my vision was exceptional. I even thought the glasses were some kind of signal or sign or proof that my vision was sharper than anyone else's. It wasn't really a comparison. I didn't think, oh, my eyes are better than all the other children in my class. It was simply that I thought I could see that which others could not, that I could hear that which others could not, that I could smell something on the air that no one else could smell. Now, I wasn't ever looking for proof of this. I simply knew it to be true, in the way that I knew that I could control the wind. Now, the only real measure of this, I suppose, and it didn't mean anything to me, was that I was faster than anyone else in the class. And that felt likely to me because I would had all these other things. I could see further, smell more, hear everything in the world. Of course I would be faster. So when I was a boy, and I would walk everywhere as a boy. I walked to school, all around walking. When I was on the road, I would experience what I have just mentioned. I would be able to smell the people's lives as they drove by in their cars. And it also got to the point that I was smelling, or thought I was smelling, unusual objects that you would not normally consider odoriferous. Things that seem to lack fragrance or lack a penetrating fragrance. And in fact, I believed I could smell books in automobiles as they passed books from the library. Because back then, everyone made use of our local library, as I did. And I was particularly fond and curious about the scent of books. And so, as much time as I spent in the library reading, I would also spend smelling books. I would find the oldest books I can, the most curious looking books, open them up and inhale their curious fragrance. And I felt I came to know them. I would open up Moby Dick, this old brown copy that looked like it had been pulled from the earth. And that's what it did. And it smelled like that. It smelled like a coffin. And so I felt that I had some familiarity with each of these books, or many of the books, enough that I could live in this illusion that as cars passed me, and as I catalogued all the small, subtle flavours in the fragrance of that car, that I could detect what book they had in the car. And one time, I decided, well, I should put this to the test. And I realized in that moment that it would make that this... I suppose I was getting old enough that I'd begun to wonder whether my sense of my extreme prowess was justified. And so I think I must have wanted a test. So one day I was walking along, and the car passed. And I smelled all the lifestyle, the spaghetti, and the vacuum cleaner, and the cat. And I smelled the Three Musketeers. So as the car passed me, the challenge established almost instantly that I should run as quickly as I could after this car to track it down wherever it went in the world, keeping as close as I could using my exceptionally fast legs. Then, using whatever other skills I would need, locate this car, look inside and see if my olfactory sense was as precise as I knew it to be or hoped it was. So the car, of course, going along the road, I start running after it, of course. It goes faster than me, and I don't mind that. I'm not in the business of being a superhero. And I was in touch with reality. I didn't think I could lift a mountain or outrun trains or fly. I was reasonable. I was reasonable in my sense of my own exceptional qualities, which reasonability itself seemed to be evidence of it. So the car goes off and it's gone quickly, but I feel as though I know where it's going. I feel I can see through the hills and the trees. I can see it banking along the dark roads. And so I'm making my way through town, chasing this ghost. And as I say, I'm hoping to put all of my senses to the test. I don't know how I envision this to happen, how I taste the sense of touch. I imagine that I'll have to break into the car somehow using my powers. But I see that the successful discovery of the Three Musketeers in this car will be all the evidence I need. That will be the final bit, and I will never question it again. Regardless of whether I have to use my sense of taste or touch. So I'm running along the old roads, running and running, and trying to still smell the car, the book, the life, and see it and hear it, and sense it. So then at the moment where I'm close to giving up, I don't know, I'm starting to get that sense that something's not going right in this pursuit, and I'm even beginning to rationalize, well, I'll just do it again tomorrow, we'll do this for a while. It's not foolproof, still I'm being reasonable with myself, giving myself a longer length of chain. When I see the car parked in front of a dentist's office, I look inside and I see a spot on the seat where I feel like the book. That would be a good spot for the book to be. But the occupant has gone into the dentist's office. So I go in myself, and it's not something that feels good for a child to go into a professional office when they don't have an appointment unaccompanied by an adult. It's an alien, too pristine, professional environment. And it feels like you're stepping behind the counter at a store or into the vault at the bank. There's an air of unwelcomeness. You know you're not supposed to be there. It's trespass. So I peek my head into this dentist's office and I see a woman sitting in a chair next to a glassed-in office. And she's reading a book, but I can't tell what book it is. And before I can make any more determination, she's called in behind the glass. So now I'm not sure what to do. But the only thing I do know is that her name is Zimmerman. Because that's what the hygienist called her. Or the dentist assistant, or even the dentist, I don't know who she was. But she said, "Mrs. Zimmerman." And Mrs. Zimmerman got up and went in with her book, with my book, with the book that I had smelled. Three Musketeers, perhaps. So the alienness of the environment pushed me out, and I thought, all right, I know the car, I know a name. We'll put this last piece of the puzzle together at some other point in the future. I'll find out where she lives, I'll peek in through her windows. Somehow, this last piece of the puzzle will be relieved. And somehow, I gave myself an out. It was getting late, I needed to go. I had a name, I felt I can finish this puzzle later. Most of it is confirmed. I only have this last bit. She obviously has an old book. I couldn't make out what the title was, but that's how these old books are. It was even in its obscurity was confirming to me. It looked like the Three Musketeers. And I think in some way I probably liked not exactly getting where I wanted to get. So that's the origin of my book smelling. And did I ever find or discover whether this was in fact the Three Musketeers? Did I track Mrs. Zimmerman down using all the specialized enhancements that I was for some reason provided with, as I so thought? The answer it shimmers in a kind of uncertainty. To tell you that in memory I recall continuing my pursuit of Mrs. Zimmerman, tracking her down and finding out where she lived and following her about, which is what resides in memory, goes against certain other realities at the time. For example, at the time that this happened, I would not have been able to find out where Mrs. Zimmerman lived. I didn't know how to use telephone books or locate people at all. Our town was large enough that there were likely many Zimmermans. Our town was large enough that I couldn't have combed all through the streets and tracking her down. From the perspective of now, as I look back on it, that moment in the dentist's office when the hygienist called her was likely the last moment I ever saw Mrs. Zimmerman. But yet, in memory, I have composed, or did somehow, finally lay my eyes upon that book in her car. And so it was that I continued into my older youth with an ever-increasing sense of these secret abilities. Now, I was not proud of these abilities. I more was grateful and in awe of the mystery of their bestowment. My wondering was constantly of the, why was I given this extremely fine sense of smell? Why was I so lucky? There was that part of it, and then there was simply enjoying these senses. So I enjoyed seeing and hearing and tasting and smelling and touching and running to the point that I would go off on adventures simply to use these senses. And I would run quickly through the forest, and then I would stop and stare deep and as far as I could. And then I would listen as quietly as I could for as long as I might to all the rich, tiny sounds that only I could hear. And I would taste the air and smell the air, and they were the same, and they were this twinning experience of smelling and tasting the richness of the entire universe. I could smell the subtle aroma of. So I'm trying to get away from the skew that I had some sense of pride around these things, or some sense of talent, for it wasn't that. It was more like I had been given an external gift that I could make use of. Almost like binoculars, or something that I could put up to my ear to raise the level of the volume of the land. But it wasn't actually a part of me, it was a gift that I was wearing all about me, and that I was grateful for. And I believe that it was this experience of experience itself, of misunderstanding and constantly being surprised by sensory experience, that led me into the life that I've led. For not only did I spend a lot of my time looking and smelling and touching, I spent a lot of my time examining how I was looking, examining how I was smelling. I would smell something rich and beautiful, and I would not only smell it, I would remark to myself on my capacity to smell it. Isn't that wonderful that I'm smelling this beautiful thing? There was two simultaneous beauties, the beauty of the scent and then the beauty that I could experience it, and in the way that I did. And so, I'm walking along the road with a feather in my pocket, heading down to the pet store with its trading cards, and in these days its Christmas ornaments in the window, to see if this curious feather that I found attached to my ceiling above my bed, to find out what sort of bird it might be. And the moment I get to the pet store and I look inside it and I see its drudging arrangement, its spectacular non-cohesiveness, its clutter. I regard this fact of information of what bird it is to be a part of that clutter, and not something that I want to know in its exactness. So I turn, I leave the name of the bird, whatever it is, inside the shop. The potential name, for I don't know if he could even name it. And I go home, and I've even left the ladder up in my room. Climb up it, and I put the feather back where I found it. And I wonder, is it possible? Have I somehow set the feathers there myself?
Yankee, Hotel, Foxtrot.
You're listening to the Radio Ghost on the Clutch and Wiggle Network. If you want to call and leave me a message, voice message, dial 603-722-0540. That's 603-722-0540. That goes right into something Sean set up, a Google Voice account. So there's no phone that rings, it's simply a messaging service, and we can play your message. If you have a question, if you have a statement, if you have an answer, anything you like. And we'll play the your message into a future show or not. If you just wish me to address something, I can do that. Subject to talk about, music to play. Or you can write me at showinsleeves@yahoo.com. showinsleeves@yahoo.com. All these shows are kept on both Radio Ghost, radioghost.com, and atomsmotion.com. You can listen to all the Atoms Motion and the Void stories, all the Radio Ghosts, all the Kittery Embers. And yes, for those of you who wonder, Kittery Embers will one day come to a conclusion with the Chapter 18. And for those of you wondering about the new AMV Adventure of the Whippoorwill, it's a paradox. I'm hard at work on the next stories, and they should be coming out soon. I think this is the sounds of a walk. So see you in a moment. Wouldn't you know it when I left the cane back at home? I mean, I knew it right when I went out the door, but I didn't. Sometimes I take it when I don't need it, and then other times I know that my leg hurts and I should grab it and bring it and... What does that say about me? Always pursuing an opposite course. I'm so difficult with myself. Ornery. I think that's human nature. How are you ornery with yourself? Ornery, the word is. Nothing else but. Do you know what it is, though? When I don't bring the cane, it's like the right arm, which is my cane arm, gets a little vacation. It gets very excited. Oh, I don't have to do the cane business. I'm free. I can roll around, reach out for the flowers, and just do nothing. I have no responsibilities during this walk. And that's actually true. One part of my body seems to have its own state of mind. It's pleased with this walk. Now my right leg, which is the one that hurts, is not pleased and is angry at my right arm for convincing me to leave the cane back at home. Now, I don't know if the right arm had anything to do with it. But it can seem that I've got different states of being and states of self in different parts of my body. My leg has a thought, let's go there. My arm has a thought, leave the cane. I walk out the door. I hear myself say, oh, you're forgetting the cane, go get it. And then another voice comes in and says, oh, no, don't. Let's not this time. And then it's a conversation. It continues. And I say to myself, yes, but the leg is hurting more than normal. And then I say, well, that's okay. And then I say, yes, but really, that's no way to be with yourself. Just don't be stupid. Grab the cane. It's right there. Turn around right now and get it. Because I'm walking away. These conversations can carry on until there's some point of no return when I get to the forest and I know I'm not going back, then it stops. But until I can be absolutely certain I'm not going to turn around. It's a dreadfully boring conversation I have with myself about a lot of things. Should I have another cup of tea? Well, you've had two. What's wrong with three? Might be something wrong with it. It's evening now. I did go out for a walk earlier. And I notice in these pre-winter days, it's not quite full winter. I notice that the air and everything around gets that dismal beehive look. It's a stick-coloured world. Very grey and crestfallen. Ashen. Contracted. Stripped. Not a very colourful time. You have to wonder what that has, that lack of colour. What is the effect it has on people? And then again, when the winter arrives and the snow everywhere, at least here, the snow white, blinding white, then the blackness of the trees, this monochromatic quality. What does that do to people's moods? We go from the full-colour flowers, very vibrant greens and browns, earth tones, but still there, they feel very colourful. And then we go into the stick-coloured pre-winter. And then finally into monochromatic winter. But all along our moods are shifting, turning and shifting. Banking. Which reminds me, I never talk about the banking industry. It's simply an aside. I should like to. There are some things I know so little about. I cease. We simply cease. Just walk right into the wall of the banking industry. I must tumbled over right there, just mentioning it. Honestly, the two times I've just mentioned it, I almost fell down. Banking industry. There I go again. Right off the path.
Dear Sherwin, I, as a Brit from across the pond, am writing to thank you for all of your most excellent expressions. Your thoughts, words, musical taste, and introspections are a feast for the ears, and not least for the mind. Also, I find that you provide great food for thought, a provision that I feel most reassured for. And I should like to add that your powers of articulacy and frequent poeticism are an inspiration to me, just as deeply as I am sure they are for all of your listenership. Reservedly, I urge you to read these words during a broadcast of Atoms, Motion, and the Void, for it is only in that instance of scrutiny that your listeners would be truly united in their appreciation for you, when they are able to see what a real impact you have had on the life of at least one of your listeners. I have no grand fable to tell you, only my sincerity to share. Yours fondly, Edward H. Simmons.
I get messages sometimes, like that. That one came in the form of an email with the text of the letter and then an attachment of that audio with the request that I obviously, that I either read it or I could play the audio that he attached. And I say thank you, Edward. And I'm grateful. I wouldn't normally play such a thing, but it was his request, and so there it is. I recently got a message from Liza, who listens in the south of France. She's originally from Vermont. A very kind and wonderful and thoughtful letter. Everyone who's ever written me, it's always kind. I know there are people out there that don't care for me at all, and that's fine, but they don't write me. I don't get wicked notes. It's kept outside of my sphere of awareness. I only hear the kind things. I got something in the mail. Another friend. Another friend I don't know. Let's see if I can read some of it here. It's from someone with the imagined name Ofton Connison. I don't know if that's how he pronounces it. And he had emailed me and asked if he could send me something through the mail, and I'd given him Sean's address, and so he sent it to Sean. And it's mostly just similar to Edward's note, a kind note like that. And at the bottom he writes, P.S. I've also enclosed a small parcel of dental radiographs from one Mrs. Zimmerman. There is no real reason, I suppose, for my including this. Radiographs for the radio ghost, if you will. I've had them for a number of years and have found no use for them as yet. Please feel free to discard them if you wish. And so, I have these radiographs, dated March 27, 1940. From Mrs. Zimmerman. Who I observed once upon time. Reading The Three Musketeers. Now these radiographs are like, I suppose as I'm looking at them, they're primitive x-rays. They look like poor x-rays. They're on black, transparent vellum. And faint images of Mrs. Zimmerman's teeth. Now, it may not be, and who can ever know, that I wielded mildly extraordinary powers when I was young. It may not be the case that I could ever, or now, smell the presence of a book in a car as it passes. But what can be said is that the world almost always will tie itself back together again. A mystery is a knot undone and left open and yet perceived. The mystery is where the universe has ceased to present a willing form, that the willing form has been undone and sent away, and in its space there is left some mystery, which eventually the universe will tie back together. So whether or not Mrs. Zimmerman was reading The Three Musketeers, at least I know that she was there, and that I knew her. That all the days of my life are not so completely imaginary as they seem. That I may take the feathers on my ceiling as feathers of a bird that may or may not be possible to name. And at some point in the future, when the feathers are no longer there and I begin to doubt the experience, I could possess that as well. In the way that I will now always remember Mrs. Zimmerman. I suppose it is mostly that there is this ongoing case of things being there and not there. And that all of my adventures, like those adventures I had as a boy, that means we're getting to the ending, that all of my adventures are in service to that expression. Well, my friends, it's time. Always merry and bright to you. Good night. It's time and I'm late. The old frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll slip through town. Side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sleep. It's tired and I'm late. Untie your candles, I just lit the skates. We're sitting in sleep at light, come dreams that we're sleeping right. But now it's time to swim.
Hit a ball now.
It's tired and I'm late. Your frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town. side ever turn up thing down. But now it's time to sweep.